Hello, and welcome to the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast. This is John Goodwin, your host. This podcast is dedicated to the aspiring writer or artist and will provide inspiration and tips from top professionals in the field, along with contest winners and a few surprise guests. Today's podcast is very special as it's our 100th podcast since creating us back in 2019, in April 2019, when we started this podcast. And we have a very special guest, the publisher of Bain Books. Welcome, Tony Weisskopf.
Glad to be here. Nice to be talking with you, John.
Yeah, we almost had a thing happening in April when you were going to come out and be your keynote speaker for Writers of the Future, Volume 36. It didn't happen because of this little bug that was going around and seems to still be going all around. But anyway, so I need to do an interview with you on the podcast, and so this is great. So I guess the first thing is, how did you become the publisher of Bain, and what drew you in that direction?
Well, I guess I've been a reader of science fiction since I was a little kid. My dad is an astrophysicist, and whenever he went on a trip, send a rocket up to White Sands or something like that, he'd come back with a magazine of science fiction and analog in his pockets, and he always had science fiction books around the house. Heinlein and Andre Norton were some of his favorites. So I grew up with, I grew up reading science fiction, and really just the more I read it, the more I liked it. And I knew I wanted to be part of that. So when I went to college, I discovered I was really spending more time doing science fiction than I was probably on my classes and things I should have been paying attention to. So I got a job in science fiction as soon as I graduated from college, and that was at Bain Books. I started out at the entry level position and never left. So I've had a chance to do all the jobs at Bain, including production, and I've discovered the things that I'm good at, which is not production. and when Jim passed away, I inherited his part of the company and ended up running it. And I've been doing that since 2006, so that's 14 years now. And we've managed to take some books to the top 10 in the New York Times list, managed to get some new authors on the New York Times list under my tenure. We've expanded our ebook program. I'm really proud of what the team has done here at Bain.
Absolutely. Now, what's your basic philosophy as compared to other science fiction and fantasy publishers? Like, what's your basic bent, or what makes you different?
Well, I'll steal a line from Sharon Lee and Steve Miller in their biography. We firmly believe something to the effect of, we firmly believe that science fiction should be fun, and I do too. That's at the core of what we do. Is we try to make every single one of our books a fun experience. Now, of course, the pleasures of science fiction, are different from, say, the pleasures of watching soccer, whatever those may be, or bowling, or riding your motorcycle, or climbing mountains, or whatever. But the pleasures of science fiction are visceral ones, but they're also intellectual ones. We get to ask what if in a whole range of different ways, from what if we change time or history in this particular way, or to what happens if this goes on. We get to explore all the big questions. What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be a hero? And why should we go on? What is the purpose of life? We get to do all of that with science fiction, and that is so much fun.
Yeah.
And I really, really enjoy that. So part of what I'm doing at Bain is picking things that I just like to read. And I happen to be lucky enough to have a taste that a lot of people agree with. And that's a useful thing.
Absolutely. And just going through, before we did this, when we scheduled this interview, I went through to see on your list who all you publish. And I was amazed at how many of our judges and past winners are published by Bain Books. I'm just going to read down this list because it's quite impressive, and it makes sense based on what you just said and what you look for. But Eric Flint, he was a winner, and now he's a judge for our contest. And he's the alternate history, which is the 1632 series.
Well, he does a lot of other stuff too. It's just alternate history is what his Times bestseller list books have been. But he does a huge range of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Nancy Kress, Anne McCaffrey, she was just such a dear friend. And then obviously her son Todd now is a judge, took over for her. But Larry Niven, who I just recently had on the podcast, Andre Norton, who I never met her in person. I talked to her over the phone because she was a judge. And I loved her Witch World series. That just, to me, was one of the best inspirations of fantasy. I've read that multiple times. Jody Lynn Nye, Fred Pohl, Jerry Purnell, Tim Powers. He teaches the workshop, and he's also one of the teachers for the online writing workshop that we released a few months ago.
He's great. I mean, just a master of fantasy, wonderful person.
Yeah.
And just so happy to be publishing his books now.
Yeah, which is great. Charles Sheffield, obviously he passed, but he was one of our first judges. Katie Wentworth, she was a winner who became a judge and coordinating judge, and then she passed away a few years ago. Jack Williamson, I remember when we went to the Rise of Future Awards event, we went to Cape Kennedy. This was, I guess, the early 2000s, and he'd been writing about science fiction, about space travel since the 1920s, but he'd never seen an actual rocket launch. So we were there for when the space shuttle launches, and he was like a little kid. He was in his 80s, but he and all the other judges were just like little kids. They've been writing about this stuff for ages, and then seeing one, we were the closest civilians to the actual rocket launch. We were there in the swamps. And about a mile away, he was just so ecstatic. And then you also published Roger Zelazny. And then some of our winners, Stoney Compton, James Glass, Martin Shoemaker, Eric James Stone, and Brad Torgerson. And then just recently, Sean Patrick Hazlett with his anthology of the Weird World War III, which we did helped him out with a ton of media. A lot of, interestingly enough, he got a lot of interest from the paranormal radio stations, which makes sense. Yeah. And then William Ledbetter. So anyway, so anything in particular on these authors that and how you ended up with some of these winners?
Well, I think your brief, as I understand it, is to identify authors who are looking to make a professional career in science fiction, who show that spark of a unique voice early on, and to be able to help them out at an early stage and encourage them. And I think you're doing a great job. I think your system has been able to identify these authors consistently over the course of the contest. Mm-hmm. I think part of that is, you know, the people you pick as the judges are themselves accomplished authors who are very intelligent people, and also who partake of that Heinleinian pay it forward philosophy.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So that makes sense in that. And then on the subject now of you said with professional authors helping to choose. Now, one thing about these professional authors is they all grew up through the conventional editors, publishers, to be able to make that filtering, the winnowing of the process of, so that what surfaces is the really, really good stuff. Now, I know that self-publishing is becoming quite a solution as well with the number of authors and stuff. How do you see the relationship, or what do you see as the difference?
Well, taking a look at this list, I know that Charles Sheffield was somebody that Jim Bain pulled out of the slush when he was reading for Galaxy magazine. Jim also published Jerry Purnell back in his magazine days, although he was publishing not just fiction but also his nonfiction. So you had these early relationships between editors and writers that were established through the way that the profession was organized back in the day, and that's something that's changing now. Right, there are not as many magazines as there were before, so you don't get to identify identify new talent from reading their short stories in magazines first, necessarily. And you don't necessarily have that stimulating interaction between editor and new author that you had, say, with John Campbell or Fred Pohl back in his day. So these are differences in the way that we're getting writers and editors together. But for me, always the key with self-publishing is that the second word there is publishing. So all of the tasks that publishers do still have to be done. They're just done by one person, the self, right? So all of the things that we're supposed to do as publishers, edit the manuscript, find a market, market to that market, get print books, and when I say print books, I include format for e-publishing as well. Create covers, create marketing copy, create marketing plans. All of that stuff still has to be done. It's just one person who's doing it. So you lose some of that interaction, and you lose some of that stimulation, and you lose some of that maybe edge that working with an editor will get you. And you can buy editors, but that itself is not necessarily the best way to find an editor, someone who understands your work and who can help you better your work. I'm not saying it isn't, but I'm saying that there might be flaws in that system, just as there are flaws in any system. And what I'm seeing looking forward from that too is that some people are better at those tasks than other people, all of the non-writing tasks that go into publishing. And what's happening is that they're starting to publish their friends' books, and they're becoming publishing houses.
Right.
So in a sense, they're recreating the wheel, where there are established publishing houses who have all of this expertise in one place, and they're new guys, and they're coming in and they're figuring out how to do this stuff, and some of them are becoming very successful, and this is how you get new publishing houses. So
right, okay, yeah. So it's just curious now on the traditional versus the self-publishing, and just, like I said, the winnowing process. You know, Bob Silverberg was quite emphatic about it. And also, you know, having the judges and people that could defend and stand up for that process to really make sure that what you get at the outset is something that's really worth reading. And you're going to like, wow, that was really good to find the good stuff. And, you know, I think Amazon now with their review, their stars, is they endeavor to make that one of those winnowing processes. How much do you look to self-published authors to find people to bring on board to Bain?
I think even 10 years ago, if you sent a manuscript into a traditional publisher and said it was self-published, it would be a strike against you, right?
Uh-huh.
Nowadays, I don't think that's true, just because it's that process is so ubiquitous, but we don't hold it against you. But it's also not particularly a plus either. At Bain, we try to make sure that we treat all of our authors in the same way, whether they're agented or unagented, whether they've been published before or unpublished before. What I'm looking for is I am really just looking at the manuscript. Does this story that I am reading right now take me where I want to go? Is it fun? Is it science fiction and fantasy? Is it something that is stimulating to read? Am I seeing a voice that I want to spend several hours with? That's all I really care about. All the rest of it comes after that, because if you don't have that compelling story that you want to keep on reading page after page after page, none of the rest of it matters.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was looking at an Andy Weir type thing, where he did his first one self-published, and then because he was able to demonstrate that he had something, that then his next book then went, you know, to a house.
Well, you know, it did, I think I'm forever grateful to him to prove that there is a large mass audience for hard science fiction, and that they really, you know, that they are underserved. We do publish hard science fiction. We're very proud to do it, but
yeah.
The upside of hard science fiction is just as high as the upside on quest fantasy, and I think that's actually a very hopeful sign for our culture. but the way that Weir did it was actually very similar to the way that Eric Flint wrote his first 1632 novel. Eric had was doing research for his alternate history, and so he asked questions on Bane's Bar, which is our social media platform that was started way back in the day.
Yeah.
And so to some extent, the research was crowdsourced. And Weir did the same thing, so that there was already, as he was writing it, a group of people who were invested in the story, because they were taking part in the intellectual challenges of writing it. And I think that's one of the reasons why it got such a such good word of mouth, right? Is it had that inherent buy-in from the readership. Of course, there's a very fine line between crowdsourcing, answering questions, and being lazy and not doing your own research, right?
Sure.
I think Weir and Flint were on the correct side of that line.
yeah, for sure.
Readers. Readers can smell bullshit. They really do. They can tell when you're faking it. They can tell when you're phoning it in. They can tell when they're being used. And it's not good. You don't want that. You want true, honest enthusiasm for the thing that you're writing.
For sure. Now, with respect to what, if you have a choice between two great stories, and there's a lot of great storytellers out, but two great stories. Does it matter that a person has no social presence and someone else has a very prominent social presence for who you're going to choose? Does that affect your decision?
Having a very prominent social presence doesn't hurt. But if you're the kind of person who is not good on social media and doesn't have a blog or doesn't put themselves out there, so long as that story is good, doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. If there were two great stories, I'd buy both.
Well, that's good, because that's a bit of a different perspective I've had from other people talking. So I'm really glad we're talking about this right now, because there's been a lot of, because of the whole idea of self-publishing, you need to have the ability now to wear that hat as well of promoting yourself. So you've got to be an instinctive success at self-promoting if you're going to do it, because you don't have the publishing house that has that hat that they're going to wear for you. So you need to, that's part of one of the hats you're going to have to be able to do then, I guess.
And that is a problem with self-publishing, right? Is that that is the publisher's job. The publisher's job is to find that market and to make that market aware of your fabulous work that they're going to love. And if all you want to do is sit there and write your fabulous stories, and you don't want to have to go be a salesman or an actor or any of that kind of stuff, that's fine. That's what publishing houses are absolutely there for. So they should do that. And if you're self-publishing, yeah, that's going to be a problem, because that is a task of publishing, is finding that audience to publish, to make it public, right?
Right.
And it is very hard for the reader to be able to winnow out all of the stuff that people are burning to get out there, but you are not burning to read.
Yeah, exactly.
I think of myself when I'm reading the slush or I'm looking, deciding about a manuscript, I think of myself as the reader's advocate, right? I am there to protect you from all the crap that's out there. And that also is what a publishing house is supposed to do. It's supposed to say, this is the good stuff. Now, everybody's definition of good stuff is going to be different, which is why there should be lots of different publishing houses. But to say, when I put that Bane logo on there, that means something. So I started out as a reader. What I want is to make sure that the kind of stuff that I want to read is out there. When you self-publish, you have to establish that brand yourself, and that can be difficult.
Got it. That makes sense. Now, in terms of some of them pitching to Bane, is there any do's and don'ts of what to do? Whether Well, that's not so much in person right now. Hopefully at some point in the near future, or not too recent, we'll be able to do the in-person stuff too. But do's and don'ts from a for an author.
Well, you know, it's a profession, right? We're looking for that amazing manuscript that takes us away. But we're also looking for a long-term relationship with an author. So if you approach it as a job, you want to do your research, right? You take a look at what it is that we publish. You take a look at what it is that we don't publish. You know, we are science fiction and fantasy. If you are not clear if your manuscript is science fiction or fantasy, we will not be interested in your book.
Right, exactly.
So we say we publish at the heart of science fiction and fantasy. And, you know, just a professional presentation is all we're looking for there. You know, there's a million places that you can go to, you know, to get tips on that. And, you know, just read our guidelines, you know.
Good. Okay. That makes sense on that. Yeah. Now, you know, you have your core of Bane, but how often do you, I guess it's like you said, you go based upon what, you know, you like. But like at one point, steampunk was brand new, or people uploading their their psyche into a computer network to live. How often do you go into, so although steampunk now is like, oh, I know about that, but, you know, 5-10 years before it was the thing, it was the first stories were being published in Writers of the Future, because we tend to be 5 or 10 years ahead of the curve of what's mainstream out there. How often do you go for the new stuff, the something that's untried as yet?
Well, this is part of the problem of having been reading in the genre for, you know, almost 50 years now. There's nothing new. There's nothing new. We were publishing at Bain, Bob Shaw's Wooden Astronauts stuff that is absolutely, you know, steampunky in a science fiction kind of form. You know, and that was the early 80s. It's uploading your consciousness. We've been doing, you know, science fiction's been doing that for, you know, decades, long, long time. So I guess for me, there's no real new ideas. It's just how people handle them.
Okay. Well, there's an answer I wasn't expecting, but that's good. That's that's definitely good. Because one thing, like with our judges, because they also have a similar, you know, attitude. It's not that, like, they're definitely interested in another take on Cinderella. You know, here's two different types of personalities, but it's just a Cinderella story. They're definitely looking for something that's fresh. And sometimes I'm definitely, amazed at some of the different types of stories that make it in Writers of the Future. You kind of go, you know, that it's something that we have is it's not based upon a theme, because you can have dark fantasy, light fantasy. Here's some stuff with religion, and then all of a sudden you now have these, robots that convert into the toys that become robots. They're an acting company. They're an acting troupe that travel around, and then they turn on their various performances and become the different stage and scenario like that. It's like, wow, there's all types of different stories that make it in there. So it has to be this type of a story, other than the fact it has to be able to be appropriate for middle school on up. And there's no, we don't do the profanity or the heavy sex stuff. But is there anything that we just didn't have it just, if Tony likes it, then we're good?
For the most part, that really is true. I mean, I think science fiction and fantasy are more attitudes, more approaches to fiction than sort of strict genres like noir or romance or even the Western, which are more tied to specifics. Fantasy and science fiction are an approach to the material.
Right.
So it's very hard to pin down.
Right.
You know, and of course, there's stuff that I like that wouldn't be appropriate for Bane. I like a lot of different kinds of things, but Bane has a very specific brief. And just because I like something doesn't mean that I think that it will be something that we can do well with. And that, you know, that that's happened a few times too, but that's fairly rare. I mean, right. Most of the time, if, you know, if it's a great story, you know, well, I'm going to publish it, and that works.
Okay. So now going back to 1995, there
that's
was a
very,
book.
That's a very specific year.
It is. And we're going to talk about greasy, grimy gopher guts. Yeah. When I was doing my research for this interview, I totally got stuck in that because I, you know, immediately the jingle got caught in my head and I just, it didn't go away. And now that I've just brought it up, it's back there again. But what was the inspiration for that story? And because that's just fantastic to me. I just think that that's just fantastic.
Well, that was a book that I did with Josepha Sherman at August House, which its publishing company has since passed into the dim mists of time, but for a while was a really big powerhouse in folklore. And Josepha, my collaborator, had several books published with them. And this was just a project that I had always wanted to do. I enjoyed the subversive jingles when I was a little kid, and as I was older, and I studied anthropology and linguistics, I became, you know, more interested in specifically what role these subversive children's rhymes had in our culture, and I wanted to preserve some of them. And Josepha was a willing partner in crime on this, and a project that I had been, you know, sort of had on the back burner and steaming for many years. She turned the fire up, and we actually turned it, you know, actually made it happen. Turned it into a book. August House did a great job with it, and so Greasy Grammy Gopher Guts. And again, sort of, on the back burner. There's a sequel to Greasy Grammy Gopher Guts going along. We have a whole new generation of kids and their subversive rhymes and the things that they sing about. And one of the interesting mechanisms there is that you forget that stuff, right?
Yeah.
That, you know, they are things that you do when you're a kid, but when you grow up, you forget them until somebody says Greasy Grammy Gopher Guts. Get this memory cascade.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And that is a neat process, neat neurological process to it.
Absolutely.
To look at.
Yeah. On the side of then with Bain and yourself, then, as did you go very much into writing and then editor and then publishing, or editor, writing, publishing, the relationship between those two functions of writing and editing?
Well, I never had an ambition to be a science fiction writer. My ambition always was to enter on the editorial side. John Campbell and, you know, Fred Pohl were who I wanted to be. Didn't want to be Horace Gold, but, you know, with the panic, there it is. So
yes,
we're all a little bit Horace Gold now.
Yes.
Working with writers and working with artists is what I wanted to do, and that's how I got here. I wanted to be on the editorial side. I wanted to be in book publishing, and that's what I got. And the writing, I've always been interested in writing nonfiction, but never saw a particular need to turn my hand to fiction.
Okay, so then the Greasy Grammy Gopher Guts, that was a very specific thing with a very specific project in mind to not lose sight of our childhood jingles with their ulterior meanings.
Exactly.
Okay.
And there are a couple other projects that I have, and as I said, simmering on the back burner there, including a biography of Wilson Bob Tucker, who was a science fiction writer. He was a mystery writer, and he was integral into the creation of science fiction fandom. So without Bob Tucker, you know, we don't get any of this. He was a great guy. I knew him well, and his story deserves to be told.
Okay, well, that makes sense. Now, I'm just curious, are you familiar with any of Elrond Hubbard's fiction works at all?
I am, yeah. I was good friends with Algis Budrys, and he turned me on to some of L. Ron Hubbard's work. And of course, I had run across his fiction before, just as one does reading science fiction. And they're fun.
Yeah. And I was because you mentioned Fred Pohl, because a lot of the judges that we had, unfortunately, some of them have passed. Talked about. His science fiction and fantasy during the Golden Age, and how he worked with Campbell, and Bob Silverberg still talks about some of the various stories of Campbell with Hubbard, and then Fred Pohl, and even Mike Resnick, just his favorites, and just how he was able to take something and turn a different direction into the genres. I think Fear is Bob Silverberg's favorite story, and Typewriter in the Sky was Mike Resnick's.
I tend to like the lighter stuff. Typewriter in the Sky was fun for me too.
Yeah. So you made mention artists now, because we have the Illustrators of the Future contest as well. So I didn't even think to ask you about this, but then in terms of the cover artists and illustrators that you use for covers, and then maybe you do or maybe you don't inside panels as well. Something about that, how you, do you have a stable, or are people able to submit to becoming illustrators for Bane?
Both actually. We have a stable of artists that we turn to. They're all freelancers, of course, but we're also open to new artists, and I will take a look at portfolios and samples. We have an art director at Bane.com email, and we do take a look at that. Whenever I go to science fiction conventions, I always take a look at the art show and look for new talent. Dragon Con especially is great for its art show. It's a juried art show, I believe, and be huge. Just a great forum for artists. But yes, we do welcome new artists. And I am the art director for Bane. This is not the usual way things go. But Jim was the art director before me, and I thought I'd try my hand at it. There's a very specific branded look to Bane.
For sure. Yeah.
And that's intentional. It's a form of science fiction art that I think of as romantic realism. So for a lot of our covers, the intent is we want you to be able to fall into that picture. We want you to be able to go, ooh, that's a story I can get into. And how an individual artist interprets that brief, that's what makes for just brilliant art. We use Bob Eggleton regularly. We use Tom Kidd. We use David Mattingly, we use Dave Seeley, we use Steve Hickman, and I Kurt Miller is another one who's been doing great art for us. There's a bunch of them, and I have to say I'm just so proud of what they've been doing. I think their illustrative art is the best in the business. I think this is what you're going to be seeing 100 years from now in galleries. They are making beautiful, beautiful things.
Yeah. You mentioned Dragon Con, and Pat Henry obviously is a very good friend, and going way back to when we used to share the costs of bringing Anne McCaffrey over from Ireland for Writers of the Future and Dragon Con. But he was our keynote speaker at Writers of the Future, I think, 5 years ago, and he talked about dragons and all the different colors of dragons and significances of the dragons. And he had no idea of the impact of the Writers of the Future and Illustrators of the Future contest for the industry, as well as the awards event, how much media covered it, and just, the number of judges who were involved, who these people were. So after that, he's at Dragon Con, he's made sure that we've had a display. He provides a display for the Illustrators of the Future contest, a table,
great,
a panel,
mm-hmm,
and just enable him, because once he found out what it was and what it meant, wanted to make sure he could validate that, reinforce that, because I think Dragon Con has got the last major art show. It's a lot of the other conventions have really tamed down to hardly anything.
Well, there's a lot of reasons for that. But
sure.
Yeah, I think Dragon Con absolutely does it right.
Yeah. So anyway, on this, with respect to now the future of science fiction and fantasy, the hard copy reading, the ebook reading, the audiobooks, any particular trends you see that, you know, because there's the overall things that like PW will say in that, you know, that they're looking at, but just specifically for science fiction and fantasy, how you see that's going in any directions?
Well, you know, I think in you know, general terms, we're all seeing a lowering of our paper numbers, a concomitant rise in our audiobook numbers, and I think we've, if not saturated the ebook market, at least we're at the point of that particular medium where everybody who has wanted to has filled up, has rebought all the backlist that they want to, you know, just like we went from, you know, wax into CDs, you know, you went back and you bought your whole collection and or DVDs for movies, you know, you replaced your VHSs with DVDs. Everybody's done that at that point. And so I think we're going to see a rise in new stuff. I think more people are going to be interested in new things. You know, of course, with electronic publishing, you have this idea that not only do you have to be better than the other books published that month, but you also now have to be better than everything else that's ever been published.
Yeah.
And that's not hard, right? That's not heavy.
Yeah.
I think that the way that ebooks are going is potentially a dangerous direction, where you're not buying the book, but you're renting the bytes, right? And at Bain, that's not how we do it. At Bain.com, you buy the book, you bought the book. If you want to download it again, you can download it again. If you're desktop got fried, or the laptop fell in the bathtub and you lost your phone, you can still go back to Bain and get your book. You've already paid for it. We're right. Not going to change the book. We're not going to change with the text.
Right.
We're not going to mess with it. It's your book, and we're not going to second guess it. And I think that's just a useful thing to know going into, you know, what we might be calling, you know, the crazy years for the next decade or so. I don't know. We'll see how that goes. But I think I think in terms of the overall number of people interested in science fiction and fantasy, if anything, they're growing. Certainly in this last crisis year, we've seen a very nice not a drop in our sales at all. People are looking for our stuff. They're finding it, and I just hope that once we get through this crisis, that we'll see a return to retail bookstores, and we'll see a nice rise when they come back as well.
Okay, well, that makes sense. Do you find, has Amazon been of assistance, or it's just another outlet basically that's really taken advantage or been able to take advantage of the current pandemic?
You know, Amazon is what it is. It reaches a lot of people. It provides an amazing service, and it is definitely, you know, one of the places that you can get Bain books.
Has it helped global sales for you?
You know, we were always pretty global. Simon & Schuster, our distributor, has had good international sales reps that do well with our books. So we've always had a good global presence. When we set up Bain's Bar, we were able to reach across the world to our fans, so that they could find our fans in New Zealand would know, you know, way before anybody else, because, you know, it was, you know, things, because it was a different time of day for them, right? You know?
Yeah.
So our fans could always find us. You know, they've been able to find us for 20 plus years, and that's continued. So I wouldn't say that Amazon has, you know, it doesn't hurt. But it's an additive thing for us.
Got it. So the Bain's Bar and your own social presence. And I know Eric Flint, was he the first person that handled Bain's Bar?
Well, Eric was one of the absolutely early adopters of the bar, but there were a bunch of our authors who hung out at the bar and sort of used it as their social media presence before there was even a term social media.
yeah, exactly.
And it was a way for authors to find an audience, for the audience to talk to each other. You know, the market for science fiction is geographically diffuse. This makes it very hard to market to, right?
Right.
So if you have a site that people can find, that makes it nice. So, you know, if you are the only reader of science fiction in your teeny tiny town in Alaska, you've got friends all over the world, and that's great. And we facilitated that. Now, of course, in those 20 years, we have seen a rise in all the other social media platforms. So this is not as unique as it once was. But the site still remains a magnet for our fans and a place that people know where they will find like-minded people.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So now with respect to tips or advice to the aspiring science fiction fantasy writer, any pearls you care to impart? Further, additional pearls.
Well, what people will say is that what they're looking for is a new voice, right? You're like, what the hell does that mean?
yeah.
But these days, again, with the rise of the social media platforms and the internet, nobody shares advice like writers do. It is all over the place. It's everywhere. You cannot bat an eye. Even on late night TV, you're going to find ads for "We can help you publish your book," right? So there's a lot of noise out there, and there's some information, and all about what having a voice means is test all of that against you. You know, test that against your gut. You're going to get a lot of advice. You're going to get a lot of input from other people. And that can be great, and it can be really, really helpful, but you always, always, always have to test it against what is it that you see. How it's, you know, in the end, it's your story, it's your name on it, you've got to be happy with it. So however much you want to talk to other people about your work, in the end, it's you. And so I would say to authors, have confidence in your vision, have confidence in your voice.
That's very, very good advice on that. So with respect to this interview, are there any questions I've not asked? Anything like, oh man, I thought for sure you would have asked me blah.
No, I don't know. I mean, at Bain, we do what we do. And, you know, there are some things that I think we do better than anybody else. I think we do great alternate history. I think we do great space opera. I think we do really, really good military science fiction, and we really, really understand it. There are a lot of people who will put on the dressings of military science fiction, but they don't get it. They don't understand what military science fiction is for. They don't understand the audience. And I think at Bain, we do. We understand the importance of it, and we understand the genre. And part of that is because Jim Bain helped mold the genre.
Yeah.
Publishing David Drake and Jerry Pornell and in later years Tom Kratman and John Ringo and David Weber and to a certain extent Lois Bujold. Her early works were clear works of military science fiction, joining in that military science fiction conversation. We do great urban fantasy between Misty Lackey and Larry Correa. We covered the spectrum on urban fantasy. We understand it. We like it. And we publish it well. We do hard science fiction. We understand it. We like it.
Yeah.
We publish it. We publish it well. I like quest fantasies. I love The Lord of the Rings. I loved Fritz Leibert, Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser. And I'd like to see more of that. I'd like to see more of that kind of epic fantasy. Every few decades we get some absolutely great epic fantasy. Elizabeth Moon's Deed of Pax Nerian is one. Larry Correa's Son of the Black Sword, the series that started with that book, is another now that we're publishing. But I'm really, 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 really super picky when it comes to that. So it's hard.
Yeah.
it's hard to find the stuff that really, really works for us there.
How much do you do the earlier, because this brings up a point then, because I looked at some of the people that you wrote to me that you published that were earlier our authors, but on the republishing those works, because we're in a project of republishing some of Mr. Hubbard's early works. One of you mentioned military science fiction, Final Blackout is one of the ones that Jerry Purnell was just absolutely, rave about. But how much do you rely on that as your as what Bain has to sell is the early masters of these forms of science fiction and fantasy.
It remains an important part. These are great stories.
And they
find a new audience and with new generations. So repackaging them and republishing them and letting new people find them. I think that's an important job of what a publisher does for sure. Yeah. So we will absolutely continue to do that. Now, what's appalling to me is that I'm going to be publishing books in the 80s that people think of as classics, and I think of as just came out. So.
Yeah. I mean, I've got my old copies of, like I mentioned, the Witch World series from Andre Norton. I've got my old stuff. I've got this stuff from Anne McCaffrey. And I mean, it's just what these, you know, authors did was amazing. And I think it's important that it stays there for people to know that this is their, it's like their history for their genre. They need to know that and need to know, you know, its earliest beginnings for the, you know, the current formats of what they are.
Yeah. And, you know, this is not something that, that we've talked about, but, you know, the two that you mentioned happened to be women. And, you know, women have been important to the creation of science fiction as a genre, from the very beginning.
That's right.
And they were part of science fiction, from the pulps onward, as artists, as editors, as writers. We shouldn't forget that.
Yeah. Kathy Moore was one of our first judges. And a lot of great, you know, correspondence between Hubbard and Moore earlier on when she was first getting started as a writer. But yeah, the story of when Anne McCaffrey, she was a judge the second year, and she was, when she was talking with Algis, was just up in arms that she wasn't already invited to be a judge. You know, just she was a hoot and a half.
Yeah, indeed. I got to work with her professionally and met her a few times at conventions, and that was absolutely the impression that she left, for sure. She was just full of life, life.
Absolutely. And when we bring her out for the Writers of Future Awards event, I'd go pick her up at the airport and bring her in. We'd always have – she loved root beer, and so we always had a whole display of all types of special root beers, and she would love it. And when she gave me – she autographed and inscribed it. Crystal Singer, which is one of my favorite books of hers. Mm. She, you know, thanked me for all the hires that I got every time she came out, because she just loves root beer. And then, of course, we talk about cinnamon, because that was her favorite spice, and mine as well. So, but she was she was so full of life. You're absolutely right. And she so adored the new writer and did everything she could to help, you know, give them that little boost and congratulate them when they got something published.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's how it should be.
Exactly.
That's how it should be.
Exactly. So this has been great. I very much appreciate your giving me this time to talk with you about this. I think a lot of people will be interested to, first of all, what you have to say, but also, you know, your take on the future of science fiction and fantasy. And you're just so full of hope and so full of positives about this, which is, it's really important. You know, at this time period, you know, positiveness is always a good thing to have. But you're convincing. So this is great.
Well, I've convinced myself too. I mean, I really think that the future is going to be a brilliant one, and it's going to be so much fun.
Yeah.
And I want to be part of it.
Yeah. Well, that's great. And thank you for listening. Subscribe to the Writers of the Future podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Writers and Illustrators of the Future are contests created by L. Ron Hubbard to provide a means for the aspiring writer and artist to be seen and acknowledged. It is free to enter and open to new and amateur short story writers and artists of science fiction or fantasy. And again, thank you very much, Tony.
Thank you, John.